This is a podcast about Jeopardy.
Hello and welcome to Potent Potables, your weekly Jeopardy podcast where two former competitors bring you recaps and analysis of the week's Jeopardy episodes, a deep dive into a topic inspired by one of those episodes, and a quiz. I'm Emily.
And I'm Kyle, and this is the week of April 8th, 2024. We get the end of the Jeopardy Invitational Tournament. I almost said JIT. They've got their hooks in me. And we get to the very first regular play games of the season. But before we get to that very exciting return to normalcy, Emily, how are you doing?
It is my birthday on the day we're recording. So
happy birthday.
Thank you. That's fun. So yeah, we're going to meet some people for trivia in the city this evening for my birthday. So that will be fun. And I'm in a Broadway moment right now. I've got a lot of shows scheduled to see. I just saw Hadestown again with my friend who was in town with her family. She asked for advice about what would be good for them, and I invited myself along.
Of course.
Of course. Her husband is a classics major, and her son is a moody preteen, trombonist. There were articles talking about how the Hadestown trombone part is the best trombone part in Broadway history. So
really?
Yes. When she mentioned, you should listen to a little Hadestown if you haven't. When she mentioned that he played trombone, I was like, oh, well, there's not even a decision to make here. There is just a correct answer to be found.
Yes. I guess that makes sense. Trombones historically were associated with death.
Oh.
Don't know if that's like intentional on the composer's part or if it just happens to be that way, but
I bet it is.
It probably is, yeah.
Yeah. And my son has been in his Hamilton phase, so I'm taking him to Hamilton finally in a couple of weeks. I bought those tickets like months ago. And we're also in the time of year where all the new Broadway musicals are opening. So Cabaret
That's not a new one.
No. Oh, it's a revival of Cabaret.
Yeah.
So there's a revival of Cabaret that's opening, and it's the hot ticket right now. I picked out a date and went to buy tickets for my chosen date, and there were four tickets left as single seats around the theater. So then we needed to pick a new date like a month in the future. Yeah, but we've got our Cabaret tickets, and for Mother's Day we're seeing Water for Elephants with the kids. So anyway, that's a lot about my Broadway plans. How are you doing?
Very nice. I'm doing pretty good. Not a lot of exciting details, I guess. For Mother's Day, it's looking like we're going to go to a baseball game, which would be exciting if the Rockies weren't the worst team in baseball. They might not statistically be, but I mean, I think an argument could be made, but it'll still be fun because it'll be an afternoon and the kids will be able to watch the game. And yeah, I mentioned my kids are in a theater class last week. They're really getting into it. I'm afraid we might have to have a similar off-Broadway phase here for my children.
Afraid? I guess it's not cheap.
It is not cheap, no. I mean, I will say the Denver Center for Performing Arts is not as expensive as Broadway, I am confident, in general. But also, I don't know. It's just, I made a career change in large part because I did not have the energy to handle extreme emotions from a lot of people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that indulging my children's theatrics will simply increase the amount of extreme expression of emotions that I have to deal with in my life.
Yeah, I get that.
But then again, maybe it would happen anyway.
Yeah, I feel like you get the temperament and then you get the interest in Broadway, not the other way around.
That's probably fair.
Louis' big play is coming to you around Mother's Day.
Who is? Blue? Oh, actually, yes.
Yeah.
I believe there is already a plan with my mother to take them to go see that.
And you've got the touring company of Hamilton coming. I'm like planning your Broadway.
Don't forget some good shows.
Yeah. You said it may not be as expensive as Broadway, but like, I sort of suspect, like, I haven't actually looked at pricing here, but
it might be.
The thing with Broadway is that we have got so many seats so close together that if you are not that picky about what show you're seeing or seeing things right when they come out or where you sit, you don't have to actually pay a lot for a Broadway seat.
That's fair.
Yeah. I had a friend in college who, she'd grown up in New York. and had a membership to a seat filling service. I don't know if this even still exists. And like, it was kind of hush hush, but like when a theater wanted to look like their Broadway show was successful, people who were part of this service could get tickets that I think were like free or $5 or something. But like the rule was you have to be early and you have to be dressed at least business casual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she just went to all of these Broadway shows. Often like when things were early and not successful yet was when they would use the seat filling services.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, that's a lot about theater, but that's where we are. So let's get down to the business of why we're here.
To defeat the Huns.
To defeat the Huns.
Yeah.
And that, which I guess is a euphemism for watching Jeopardy. I don't know. Yes. All right. So we'll start with Monday, April 8th. This is game two of the finals for the Jeopardy Invitational Tournament. We have Andrew He, Victoria Gross, and Amy Schneider. And the Jeopardy round categories are A to A countries, parenting, aches and pains, working hard, hardly working, pop culture is springing out all over, and slanguage.
Mm-hmm. We had a triple stumper at the $800 level of pop culture is springing out all over. And I got this one wrong. Asked to describe a perfect date, a pageant contestant in this film says April 25th, because it's not too hot, not too cold. I had attributed this to the wrong. I post this quote every April 25th.
April 25th, yeah.
Yeah.
As well,
all you need is a light jacket. That was in Miss Congeniality. Nobody attempted it. Another kind of pageant film, albeit a little different genre-wise, is Drop Dead Gorgeous. Mm. And I mixed them up. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I feel like Drop Dead Gorgeous has not had the staying power.
I will say I've never seen it, but I have seen Miss Congeniality.
Yeah. I would happily rewatch Miss Congeniality.
It was good.
Yeah.
Don't know if it still is good, but you know, 15 years ago or whenever, 20 years ago, I don't know.
Yeah. Drop Dead Gorgeous was like a dark comedy, like mockumentary about a murder in the pageant scene, I think. Yeah.
I could see how you'd make that mistake.
Yeah.
The $400 level of parenting. Young Burt Bacharach hated taking these with Miss Raymond, and they're a source of conflict in many a home. Victoria Ringham said, what are music lessons? Ken asked for specificity, and she said, what are piano lessons?
Mm-hmm.
That's accurate. I have my older daughter in piano lessons. I have for over a year now, and I try my hardest not to make them a point of contention. But, you know, with most things that the kids show interest in, we're like, yeah, sure. And then if they try it and they find that they don't like it, we're like, yeah, you don't have to keep doing it. Like, if it's a commitment, right? Like when they're on a soccer team, we're like, well, you'll do the whole season, right? But
then you don't have to sign up again. Yeah.
We don't have to do it again if you don't want to. But this might be just my own baggage, but she does not have the option to not keep doing piano lessons. Like, we are going to stick with it for a while.
Yeah.
Because she's going to get bored because she's a kid and learning things is hard. And it is important to me that she gain a truly functional foundation in it. However, she's too young to like grasp that and accept it. And so I don't want to like make it a big thing. And so I'm like constantly doing this dance of trying to keep it fun, even though we really should be like trying to get better. And one thing that ended up working out really well, her private lesson teacher, like her studio teacher, also teaches voice lessons. And my older daughter loves singing. And so she was like, I want to take voice lessons. And I was like, that's perfect because we're not in a hurry. So we can like split it. So sometimes we'll do piano and sometimes we'll do voice and you'll want to keep going back. And it'll be great. And so that's what we're doing. I was like, yes, my kid will know piano like I never did. So anyway, that's a lot about me and my kid. But if you want your kids to play piano and you want them to keep sticking with the lessons, I guess find a teacher who also does something else they're interested in. That's my advice.
Yeah, that's smart. I like that.
Yeah. So she's working on Reflection from Mulan right now.
Oh,
I was like, for your first song, you're choosing a pretty angsty one. She was like, I don't know what that means. I was like, yeah, I know. Good on Victoria for remembering all of the words in NSAIDs, the $600 level of aches and pains, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Daily Double number one is in Working Hard, Hardly Working at the $800 level. Amy finds it at pick number 17. She's at 4,400 in the lead with Victoria just behind her at 3,800. Andrew's at 1,800. Amy makes it a true Daily Double and gets the clue. This traditional term for Japan's famously hard-laboring male office workers references both wages and gender. And she gets it correct with what is a salary man?
I've never heard that phrase,
but I didn't associate it with Japanese office workers.
It is entirely new to me.
Yeah. At the end of the Jeopardy round, Amy's at 8,800. Right where we left her after the... Yeah, she flatlines after that for the rest of the round. Victoria, I don't know, gets her buzzer timing or whatever. So Victoria's at 6,800. Andrew's made it up to 3,000. And the Double Jeopardy categories are novel title characters, colleges and universities, consonant vowel times three. The example word that Ken gives is salami. A secret chord David played, and it pleased the Lord. Just a friendly note that Hallelujah is not a Christmas song.
Nor really a religious or church song at all.
Nope.
It uses certain terminology. It is very much secular.
Yeah. It uses the story of David and Bathsheba. You could unpack it in a Bible study, maybe use it as a conversation piece. But yeah, no, it's not really a religious song, and it is definitely not a Christmas song. I don't care that the word hallelujah is in it.
Right. That's not really the point of the song.
Yeah.
I loved the secret chord category, and Andrew went there first. I mean, he was kind of Daily Double hunting, but he went there first. And I was like, that's my dude.
Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah, the $1,600 level, a mighty anguished chord in his 10th symphony might have something to do with his wife Alma's affair with Walter Gropius. I'm pretty sure I never talked about that specific thing, but I feel like I've talked about Alma Mahler before.
Yeah, I feel like that's come up at some point.
There was another composer, I think it was Alban Berg, who was in love with Alma Mahler and had a doll of her made. And it was covered in shag carpet kind of material. It was very weird. He was very weird. Anyway, Alma Mahler, I don't really know much about her. I should probably look into her specifically because she apparently had a kind of an impact on at least German music of the early 20th century. Anyway, that's Mahler. And then the $400 clue would have been really obscure if they hadn't given you the other name.
Because
Wagner shook up people's ideas of harmony with the chord named for this lover of Isolde. Probably most trivia people just know the pair Tristan and Isolde. But if they were trying to get you to identify the Tristan chord, that would be a bit more obscure.
Mm-hmm.
And I could do a whole deep dive on it because it is fascinating and really interesting from a music theory perspective. But
yeah, but you can't do a deep dive on it because Andrew,
because he got it right.
Yeah.
Come on, Andrew. The $2,000 level of David played was, to my mind, possibly the easiest one of the category.
Yes.
David Bowie played the baby-stealing Goblin King in this 1986 film. That's Labyrinth. I don't think I've ever seen Labyrinth. But of course, I know that. That's the one thing I know about that film.
Mm-hmm. You should see Labyrinth, though.
I should. It's on my list of, when I remember how to, watch things on my own.
If you wait long enough, your kids will be big enough.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. I realized recently my kids are, we've talked about some things my kids are not big enough to watch or listen to. But do you remember the movie Galaxy Quest?
Yeah.
They're big enough now.
They kind of are. Yeah.
Yeah. Common Sense Media, which is fairly cautious about recommending things that might not be age appropriate, thinks they're probably big enough for The Truman Show.
I mean, I'm sure they're old enough for the content. I'm not sure they're old enough to really get it.
Yeah, they may not be old enough to really get it. But there's nothing in there that's going to, scar them, I think.
Right, yeah.
Galaxy Quest, I think they are genuinely old enough to get it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. I haven't thought about that movie in a long time.
Right? I was scrolling through nostalgic 90s movies to watch with your kids. And I was my brain erased Galaxy Quest. And it's back now. And that movie was great.
By Grapthar's hammer.
You still have the quote. Nice.
I think that's what it is. I could be wrong.
Yeah, no, you are absolutely right. That's what it is. great cast. It's got Alan Rickman. It's got Sigourney Weaver. Yep.
And there's Tim Allen, but that's okay.
Tony Shalhoub's there. It is Rainn Wilson's film debut.
Is it? Oh my goodness. It is. Yeah. He's one of the aliens, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. This isn't about any of the Jeopardy clues. So
we should get back to Jeopardy.
Yeah.
Daily Double number 2 is in novel title characters at the $800 level. It's pick number 4. Victoria finds it. She's at 11,200. Amy's still at 8,800. Andrew's at 3,000. She bets it all. She doesn't want to have another situation like on Friday where it was almost but not quite. She gets the clue. The first name of this title character of a Defoe novel is an old word for a prostitute. And she gets it correct with what is Moll Flanders.
Mm-hmm. And Daily Double number 3 is in consonant vowel times 3, pick number 17. It's at the $1,600 level, and Amy finds this one. She's at 12,000 at this point, with Victoria up at 30,000. Andrew's at 5,000. Amy does what she has to do. She makes it a true Daily Double, and she gets the clue. Catholics hoping for special grace may pray this, said for 9 consecutive days. And there's neg bait here, because rosary is consonant vowel times 3.
It is, but that's true.
But this is a novena. 9 consecutive days should help you get there, and Amy gets it. So she shoots up to 24,000.
Yeah. So going into Final Jeopardy, Amy's at 26,000. Victoria's at 37,600. Andrew's at 8,600. Final Jeopardy category is mythology, and the clue, a peasant who became the king of Phrygia created this intricate problem that was solved in 333 BC. They all got it. Andrew put, what is the Gordian knot? And he wagered 8,000. And so he almost doubles up. Amy also got the Gordian knot, wagered 11,601 to go a dollar ahead of Victoria. But Victoria also got it and made a cover bet of 14,401. So Victoria notches her first victory.
That's right. And this is a best of 5. So on Tuesday, the only thing that could keep the tournament going would be Andrew He winning. If Victoria or Amy wins, that will be their second victory. Because it's not really a...
It's like a best of 3, except you can do more than 3.
Right. Yeah.
It's the first to 2.
First to two. Yeah, because if you were committed to 5 games, you could end up with 2 contestants with 2 wins apiece. And 1 contestant with...
One.
All right. Anyway, same contestants on Tuesday. And the Jeopardy categories, World Cities, Van Life... Words that go up to 11. Each word has 11 letters. Looks like we're in business. Musical genre masters and literary lines. They had mercy on them at the $600 level of literary lines. This poet, do not go gentle into that good night. They just wanted the poet, and Amy got that. That's Dylan Thomas. At least once, but I think more than once, we've seen them ask for the quote.
Yeah.
And there are so many ways to mess up the line, do not go gentle into that good night. We've seen people say gently. We've seen them like switch the adjective.
Instead of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm glad they did it that way because, gosh, that's
watching 3 very smart people get a quote almost exactly verbatim and all lose money on it is such a frustrating experience.
It is. It does not feel good as a viewer.
It feels more like a gotcha than a trivia question. So I appreciate that they flipped it around.
$1,000 clue. He wrote the little ditty, got in his wisdom, made the fly, and then forgot to tell us why. Amy got that. That's Ogden Nash.
I feel like we know why.
Why?
Because we need to bother decomposers.
I guess. Well, did Ogden Nash know that at the time, though? I don't know.
Yeah. What were you going to say about Ogden Nash, though?
I have responded correctly with Ogden Nash on Jeopardy.
Oh, nice.
Because he is one of the few poets that I knew before I started specifically trying to learn poetry.
Mm-hmm. In the Van Life category at the $800 level, Gillette calls this beard style named for a European artist, a full goatee with a floating mustache. Victoria got that. That is a Van Dyke. I have a special place in my heart for facts that I learned while I was at Jeopardy, but they weren't on the board, if that makes sense. So it was like the whole like Alex Trebeard.
Yes.
Like social media.
God.
It was so dumb. They were trying to like make it a viral moment. Right. And Alex was going backstage and like shaving off more of his beard.
Right.
Between each show. So I think he had a Van Dyke for ours. And he's like, you know, people think this is called something else. but I can't remember what the other one thing, but it's actually a Van Dyke. So
oh, there we go. Thanks,
so that's how I learned that.
Cool.
Yeah. Daily Double number one is In Literary Lines, which we've been talking about. This one's at the $800 level, and Victoria finds it at pick number six. She's at $2,800. Andrew is at zero. Amy's at $600. Victoria wagers everything and gets the clue from Hamlet, this above all, this phrase. And she can't figure it out. There's a lot to know in Hamlet. She tries, mm-hmm. What is the rest is silence. And Ken says, no, sorry, earlier in the play, it's Polonius, to thine own self be true.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria says, oh, of course, which I bet Victoria really did do, oh, of course, but also, like, I'm probably not the only trivia person who, like, occasionally is like, oh, I should have known that. I'm like, oh, yes, 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 of course.
Right. Who, like, yeah. Like, oh, man, my reputation relies on me having actually known that. So I'm going to pretend that, oh, yeah, I was just thinking of something else.
Of course, yeah.
No, I've never done that. I've never done that.
Emily, no, I didn't think you had.
No, of course.
Yeah. So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Amy's at 4,200, Victoria at 5,800, Andrew at 3,200. And the Double Jeopardy categories are ancient history, reboots and remakes, Nobel Prizes, The Measure of a Man, opera settings, and Kneel Before Zed. These words will start with Z, but will be alphabetically before the word Zed. Okay.
You know some nerd in the writer's room just had like a moment of pure elation when they thought of that pun. They're like, Kneel Before Zed.
Mm-hmm.
I can do a category. Yeah.
The $800 level of ancient history was triple stumper. The clue there was cultivation of this fruit dates back at least to the very pre-Columbian Mocaya people, and it stood for the 14th month on the Maya calendar. Andrew tries what is coffee, and then it turns into a triple stumper. That is the avocado.
Hmm.
And like, I sort of want a month named after the avocado. That sounds like a good idea.
We just need two more.
Yeah.
What would be the 13th month then?
Toast. No. I don't know. What do you think the 13th month should be? Taylor Swift.
Oh my God. My kids would agree. Oh, that's such a tough one. Well, it would have to be really, I mean, if we're going to go along with the naming kind of like trend, it would need to be whatever is Latin for 11.
That's fair. Yeah. Okay.
That way we avoid like people getting jealous about, well, that was named for Taylor Swift, even though I wanted it to be, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I was just figuring we could change one of our 12 months to be named after the avocado, right? Because like all of our months and days are named after like the gods people used to be very concerned about appeasing.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying we need to be concerned about appeasing avocados now?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Much more than the god of war.
Oh, mighty stone fruit or whatever you actually are.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a mystery.
Yeah.
You can't comprehend the avocado.
No. It is hard enough to simply receive.
They did fine with the opera category.
They did. They did well. Good on Andrew knowing Boris Godunov as, you know, the Mussorgsky opera at the 1600s. That's not one of the first level of operas that you learn about.
Yeah, no.
Mussorgsky isn't known as an opera composer. So like, if you're like, I'm going to learn a little bit about opera, you're not going to get to Mussorgsky for a while.
Yeah.
So good on him for that. Daily Double number two is in the opera settings. It's at the $1,200 level. Pick number nine, Amy uncovers it. She's at 6,200. Victoria's at 10,600. Andrew is at 6,000. She bets it all, gets the clue. Verdi's Falstaff is set in this town during the reign of Henry VI. And she guesses what is Southwick? Southwick? I don't know how to pronounce it the way they would, but it is adapted from The Merry Wives of Windsor. So that is Windsor. So Amy drops to zero. And we got a little off on our Daily Double. So I'm going to go to Daily Double number three, which is in The Measure of a Man at the $1,600 level. It's pick number 16. Victoria uncovers it. This is her chance to put it away, to lock the game up and seal her championship. She's at 15,800. Amy's at 1,600. Andrew is at 7,600. She wagers 6,000. Gets the clue, you only need letters on the left side of the keyboard to type this unit of capacitance that's named for an English chap. And she guesses, what is Henry? I don't know of a unit known as a Henry, so I feel like she was just kind of guessing letters on the left side of the keyboard, although the H you should type with your right hand. Yeah. But that is a Farad, named for Michael Faraday.
Yeah.
So she drops down.
She does. And at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Amy's at 7,200, Victoria at 11,400, Andrew at 10,000. Don't have those big monster scores like we had yesterday. Mm-hmm. The final Jeopardy category is bodies of water. And the clue is the smallest inland sea in the world. It's completely within the territory of a single country and connects two other larger seas. They all got this one, which I found impressive.
Yeah.
I had heard of this.
This is just a thing. It's a trivia thing to know. The smallest inland sea, right?
Yep. I had heard of it, but I could not pull this one. Amy is the first one we come to, and she has, what is the Sea of Marmora? It's not quite Marmora? Spelled correctly.
Marmora.
Yeah, she has an O in there, but it works pronunciation-wise, even though it's not quite the correct spelling. She's wagered 1,400 to take her up to 8,600. Andrew also has what is the Sea of Marmora spelled correctly. He's wagered 4,401, which puts him at 14,401. And Victoria has the Sea of Marmora also, and Hi Nora. We now know that is her daughter who is taking care of her high maintenance cat. She's wagered 8,601, which puts her at 20,001 out of reach. And she wins 100,000 and advances to Jeopardy Masters.
I'm glad, like, I love Amy Schneider and Andrew He and Sam Buttry. They're all great people. I love watching them. I am glad that we're getting someone different into Jeopardy Masters, shaking it up, see how she's going to play out against the others, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The purpose, I think, it is to shake it up. And so if this tournament turns into a revolving door to bring in the people who just left, like,
right,
that's not the vision, I would think.
Right. Like, you know, in situations like the European soccer leagues, where you have multiple tiers and there's relegation and a promotion and whatever, like, there are the clubs that sit on the border and get relegated one season and then get promoted the next because they're like, that's just where they are. They're at the bottom of the top league and the top of the bottom league.
Mm-hmm.
But for Jeopardy, especially with this being new and only having six people involved in Masters, it feels much better to me to have new people coming in.
Yes. Anyway. Yeah.
So that brings us out of the Jeopardy Invitational Tournament. It brings us out of tournament play. It brings us out of people that we've seen before on Jeopardy, except for, of course, the returning champion on Wednesday, who had to wait a really long time before
He's
coming
now-
back.
As Ken noticed, he has the longest reign as a Jeopardy champion just because there was such a long break in regular Jeopardy play.
Does he?
Yeah.
What about Zach Newkirk?
Yeah, what about Zach Newkirk? How long did he go? Because he waited before Yeah.
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 Okay. We're on Wednesday, April 10th. First regular play game of the season. We have the contestants Daniel Rosenberg, a lawyer from New York, New York. Lee Wilkins, a regulatory affairs coordinator from Auburn, Alabama, and Lucas Partridge, a school counselor from Las Vegas, Nevada, whose three-day cash winnings total $66,200. Which I'm just realizing, his run didn't end, so he hasn't gotten that money yet. Oh, I mean, I know it would still be exciting to be like, I'm going to be back on Jeopardy still. Like, I know that I'm going to be back on Jeopardy, but like, oh, that'd be agonizing to know that like, I won all this money, and now mm-hmm. I have to wait.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Especially like if something changes with your taxes in the meantime or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
like you can imagine like the year turning over and being like, oh no.
Yeah, like he finished the previous season expecting like, okay, I'll be back in a couple of months when their break mm-hmm. is over and everything. And then it's like, nope, you'll be back in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And hope you weren't making any plans.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jeopardy round categories are slanging with Mr. Jennings. Music terms. Major League Baseball. Flag time, ask forgiveness, and not persimmon. Oh, the puns. Oh, the puns.
Yeah. No offense to these contestants. They did fine, but it is so weird to watch Jeopardy played by average people who are new at it.
Yeah, like The regular contestant pool. Yes. Uh-huh. And also, I would say that the level of difficulty represents that, which I appreciate. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's more fun to watch contestants get things right than to watch them get it wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Or not know it,
right? Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. I did not mean that they're like average people in terms of like, you know, but they're like the typical contestant pool.
Right.
They're not experienced super champions or whatever.
I like the music terms category.
Of course you did.
I felt it was appropriately leveled.
Mm-hmm.
Like the $200 term. From Latin for to hold, this male vocal range once had the task of holding the main melody. That's the tenor. And then later, we get down to the $800 level. These liturgical songs of the Catholic Church bear the name of a 6th century pope said to have formulated and organized them. That's Gregorian chant. There's some historicity that I'm not keen on with that clue, but the tenor, that's where that term was originally used, because there was an original chant. And then when composers started adding other layers on top of that original chant, the tenor would hold the original chant note while other people sang and added things on top.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just because we just had the slang term category in the tournament pool, but it's like two slang categories in a week. Come on, guys.
Yeah. The $400 level was diplomatically phrased. It's become controversial, but earlier this word simply described one whose eyes have become more opened to social injustice. And Lucas got that. That's woke. Before woke, the same thing happened to social justice. And then before that, the same thing happened to politically correct.
Right.
Yep.
People who feel that it is not their job to learn or acknowledge anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Decide to make dirty words out of phrases like that.
Huh? Huh? We had a reversal at the $400 level of ask forgiveness. An older Elwin Wilson, once part of this notorious white-clad group, clad with a K is a hint here, asked John Lewis to forgive him for a 1961 assault in South Carolina. Lucas rang in and said, "What is the Ku Klux Klan?" That was ruled correct, but then after the break, they had played it back, and he had added an L into the first word. It is Ku, K-U, not clue. Mm. So they had to take that money away.
Yep.
Daily Double number one is at the $1,000 level of Major League Baseball. Daniel finds it at pick number four. He's at 1,600. Lucas and Lee are tied at zero, and he makes it a true Daily Double and gets the clue. In the 1950s, this National League team temporarily changed its name so as not to be associated with communism. And he gets it correct. It is Reds, Cincinnati Reds. Apparently, they were the Cincinnati Redlegs for a while. So, yeah. At the end of the Jeopardy round, Lucas is at 3,600, Lee's at zero, Daniel's at 4,600. And the Double Jeopardy categories are the 6 mothers-in-law of Henry VIII, It's a Fact, 70s TV drama, State Capital Rivers, You Name the Capital, Books and Authors, and Does That Ring a Bell with Bell in quotation marks. We ran out of time.
Yeah. For the first time in forever, we left some clues on the board.
Who's a theater kid now?
Don't. Okay. Don't. I have two daughters. Okay. I know, there are some things that are just inescapable.
Yeah. No, it's fair. We all appreciated it.
Yeah. Thank you for speaking for everyone.
Yes. I'm confident the listeners appreciated it.
Yeah. It's a fact. Again. It's just another way of saying potpourri, I guess, because like these should all be facts, my dude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The $400 level of It's a Fact. This organization's New York City headquarters was built on land bought in 1946 with an $8.5 million gift from John D. Rockefeller Jr. Daniel got that. That is the UN. I had a congregant who, he was a cool guy. He was a World War II, like a bomber pilot. And then he worked on the construction of the UN, but he was also auditioning for Broadway shows at the time. And he got a role, and it looked like it was going to work out pretty well, because he was supposed to be at the construction site weekdays 9 to 5. And then, like, you know, the shows were like evenings and weekends, except that there was one matinee a week. It's like a 1 p.m. call. And, you know, maybe everybody take a moment and think about how would I handle that if I had a Broadway role and once a week I needed to leave work 4 hours early. What my congregant did was he told a couple of his good buddies and had them cover for him so that if the boss came looking for him, they'd be like, yeah, I think I saw him over at the other end.
Okay. Keep so running around.
For months, he was in a Broadway show and was leaving on like Wednesdays or whatever at 12:30 to get to his 1 p.m. call. And like nobody knew except for his buddies who were in the loop. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yep.
That's really cool.
Anyway, I knew the UN because like I'd heard that story and was like, oh, yeah, of course. You know, mm-hmm. Fred worked on that.
Once again, we're reminded that Jeopardy loves Colson Whitehead, $1,600 mm-hmm. level of books and authors. Ray Carney from Harlem Shuffle by this novelist was back in his 2023 bestseller Cook Manifesto. That's
yep.
Colson Whitehead.
Got to know Colson Whitehead and Ethiopia.
And Ethiopia.
And Jabberwocky.
And Jabberwocky, as we talked about. Yep. Daily Double number 2 is in It's a Fact at the $2,000 level. Pick number 11. Daniel uncovers it. He is at 7,000. Lucas is at 5,200. Lee is at 1,200. And he wagers 1,800. Man, it's been a while since we haven't seen an all-in, I guess. He wagers just 1,800. Less than the value of the clue.
Yeah.
And gets the clue. Nine of the 10 highest mountains in the world are in the Himalayas, while the other is part of this nearby range. And he guesses what are the Urals, but it is the Karakoram Mountains.
Yeah. And Daniel also finds Daily Double number 3 at pick number 19. It's the $1,200 level of the six mothers-in-law of Henry VIII. He's at 7,600 now. He's made it back up a bit. Lucas is at 7,200. Lee's at 4,400. He wagers 1,600, and his clue is not the Cromwells, but this family lived in Wolf Hall. When Henry visited in 1535, Marjorie no doubt pointed out lovely daughter Jane. And he gets that one correct. That is the Seymours. Shout out to Kyle's Wives of Henry VIII deep dive.
Yes, I did talk about them once. Not the mother-in-laws, though. Mothers-in-law.
Yeah.
So at the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Lucas is in the lead at 7,600. Lee is at 5,200. Daniel's at 7,200. It's a close game. And we get the Final Jeopardy category animated film characters. And the clue, in this 2017 film, Dante is a hairless breed known as a Sholo dog. And this was a triple stumper. I don't know if any of them have kids, so maybe they've never seen it, or maybe mm-hmm. they've only seen it once and don't remember. Lee wrote, what is a Chinese crested? That's incorrect. Wagered 3,000, drops to 5,200. Daniel wrote, what is Zootopia, and crossed that off and went with Super Pets. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Movie about animals. Sure. That's incorrect. Mm-hmm. Wagered all 7,200. And Lucas wrote, what is Luca? Which.
It's a Pixar film. It has four letters.
It's true. But that is incorrect. And he wagered everything also. Correct answer is Coco.
Mm-hmm.
It's the spirit dog. Well, he's just a dog. And then he becomes a spirit. Guy.
Yeah. Yeah. His name Dante also is kind of a clue to the death themes, right?
Yeah. But that means that Lee from third place is the winner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're back to people not necessarily having memorized the ins and outs of wagering theory. On Thursday, April 11th, our contestants are Allison Betts, a writer and creative executive originally from San Jose, California. Brian Hardzinski, a public radio producer originally from Flower Mound, Texas. It's a cool town name. And Lee Wilkins, a regulatory affairs coordinator from Auburn, Alabama, who is coming in with one-day cash winnings of $2,200, which is actually less than you get for second place. But she will go home with, at minimum, $2,200 plus the third place prize today, I guess. So
that's true.
I don't think they had bumped the consolation prizes up when we were last in regular play.
I don't think so either, because you said that and I was like, I thought it was 1,000, 2,000.
Yeah, no, they put 3,000 and 2,000 on the podiums on Wednesday. Yeah. I was like, whoa, what now?
Yeah, which is nice. That's good. Yeah. Inflation, you know?
Yeah, it's good. Like, you pay your own way out, like, to get there and, like, to stay wherever you're staying. And I can't remember how all the state taxes and stuff work, but, like, I think you pay, like, basically extra taxes on your Jeopardy winnings.
Depends on the state, yeah.
Yeah, because like maybe not if you're in California, but I think California wants a cut, even though you also have to pay your state taxes to your own state. I can't remember. Anyway, third place, you know, one and done, folks. I suspect we're losing money generally on being on Jeopardy.
Maybe, or at the very least, just breaking even, which is like, I don't know, you should get
something.
It's a cool
experience. I would, if I knew that I was going to lose money being on Jeopardy, I would do it anyway, you know.
Sure, but still, like,
but you... But when the consolation prize doesn't even cover your expenses, that seems like it's time for an adjustment. So I'm glad they made an adjustment.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Me too. The Jeopardy round categories are the Manhattan Project, TP in quotation marks, Unreal Estate, double letters in the middle, abbreviated television, and a year ending in 4. Lots of respect to Allison for her incorrect guess at the $800 level of Unreal Estate. The English village of Puddleby on the Marsh is where this animal lover has his medical practice. And she's like, a British veterinarian? I know this one.
Don't mind if I do.
She says, what is James Herriot? That's the guy who wrote like all of the quaint memoirs of taking care of the sweet baby lammies in the English countryside. I love it. Great pull. Definitely he should come up on Jeopardy a lot. I can't remember seeing him much, but this is Unreal Estate. This is a fictional town. We need a fictional character, and Brian gets the rebound. It's Dr. Doolittle.
Mm-hmm.
Allison crushes it in that category.
Otherwise, so,
she gets the $400, the $600, and the $1,000 level. The follow-up to Anne of Green Gables was Anne of this fictional Canadian town where Green Gables Farm is located in. She knew that was Avonlea. I read that one with my daughter. We're on Anne of the Island now, but we're kind of losing steam. We might change series to, you know, something else one of these days.
Abbreviated television at the $600 level. Another thing, I know that we're racking up a lot of things that we say you really just need to be aware of on Jeopardy, but another one that comes up a lot, a comedy with a bright disposition, IASIP, that's It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Weirdly, the $400 level of TP was also abbreviated television, right? Mm-hmm. Kyle MacLachlan was the clean-cut FBI agent investigating a murder in the very strange title town of this series, and the category tells you that it's going to be T period P period. Lee gets that one. That's Twin Peaks. That was sort of a weird category crossover, I thought.
Yes. Yes, it was. Daily Double number one is in the Manhattan Project at the $2,000 level. Pick number 19. Allison finds it. She's at 6,200. Lee's at 0. Brian's at 2,000. She wagers just 2,000. Gets the clue. On July 4th, 1929, Governor FDR dedicated a new building with this name, the infamous headquarters of Manhattan Democrats. And she gets it correct with what is Tammany Hall. I don't know if I mentioned if I got that far in the Tammany Hall deep dive that I did, because it was mostly about Boss Tweed. But
yeah,
I remember doing a Tammany Hall deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the Jeopardy round, Lee is up to 800, Brian's at 2,400, and Allison's in a good lead at 9,000. And the double Jeopardy categories are The Manhattan Project, Musicians' Memoirs, Food Talk, Women in Ancient Times, Colorful Geography, and Some Timely Words.
Mm-hmm.
There's a triple stumper at the bottom of the Colorful Geography category that I feel like we've talked about more than once. This river rises in the Lesotho Highlands and crosses the Kalahari and Namib Deserts before emptying into the Atlantic. That is the Orange River. That was a triple stumper. Nobody tried it. I forgot the Afrikaans name. The Oranjemon? I don't remember how to say it in Afrikaans. Or on your that's what it is. So there you go, Orange River.
I feel like Brian got some nerdy clues. I can't remember what things made me think that man knows nerd stuff. I don't know what kind of nerd he is. I don't know if he's a Star Trek nerd or a Dungeons and Dragons nerd. But like, I was like, he's in some kind of nerd community. The $1,200 level of Some Timely Words. The six-letter word means to go back in fictional time and rewrite the past of a character or narrative for a new work. And Brian knows that is retcon, which, I don't know, has a nerd vibe to it, in my opinion.
It seems to only come up in that context. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Lee was struggling in this round.
Yeah.
She managed to hang in there, but there were a number of times where she rang in and then just couldn't quite pull the word.
Yeah.
Or, you know, guessed something close but not quite right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I felt bad for her because she was clearly bringing a lot of knowledge.
Right.
Yeah. Daily Double number two is in Women in Ancient Times. Pick number 3. Allison finds it. She's at 9,800 with Lee at 2,000 and Brian at 2,400. She wagers 2,000 and she gets the clue of this lyric poet's works. Almost none have been found complete. One being the 28-line Ode to Aphrodite. and she gets it correct. That is Sappho.
Yeah. Daily Double number 3 is in Colorful Geography at the $1,600 level. Pick number 17, Brian finds it. He is at 10,000. Good score without Daily Doubles before. Lee's at 2,400. Allison's at 12,600. And he bets 2,000. I would have gone bigger, try to take the lead here. Mm-hmm. But he gets a clue. This eastern Alabama city was named for a line in an Oliver Goldsmith poem about the loveliest village on the plain. Or of the plain, I guess. And he gets it correct with what is Auburn, mm-hmm. which is funny because that's where Lee is from.
That's right. Yeah. I do sort of wonder, people have been making too small daily double wagers for a long time, long before this current tournament situation we're in. But I do sort of wonder whether the existence of all these tournaments is going to shift how people play, because it used to be that if you wanted to keep playing Jeopardy, you had to win. And with the second chance and wild card tournaments, there is something to be said for putting in a good solid game and not flaming out.
Right.
And so I wonder if it is disincentivizing people to make big wagers, because if you risk everything toward the end and get it wrong, your stats are not going to look compelling potentially for a tournament bid. Anyway. At the end of the Double Jeopardy round, Lee's at 3,200, Brian is at 14,000, Allison has just barely kept the lead at 14,600. She rang in on a $400 clue with 14,200 on the very last clue, and there was a big question of whether she was going to pull the answer successfully, and she did. She had a little, freeze, rethink, and then gave the correct answer, so kept her lead. The final Jeopardy category is space shuttles, and the clue is two space shuttles were named for craft commanded by this man, who died far from home in 1779. We come to Lee first. She didn't come up with anything. She just has who is, and a $0 wager. She stays at 3,200. We come to Brian next. He has guessed who is Cook, and that is correct. Discover and Endeavor are both named for Captain Cook's ships. You did a deep dive on him.
I did indeed.
Yeah. Brian wagered everything, $14,000. That is too much.
Too much.
But it doesn't matter because he got it right. So he goes up to 28,000. And Allison also responds, who is Cook? And she also wagers 14,000. That is the right amount because she needs to get above where Brian will be if he goes all in.
Right, which he did.
He did. He shouldn't have, but he did.
But he did.
And sometimes people will, and that's why you should make a cover bet from first place. So Allison gets $28,600 and is our new champion.
Yeah, it's a good amount of money to win.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to Friday, when we get the contestants Brian Phillips, an IT technician originally from Spring Valley, New York. Sarah Avery, an assistant reporter of Judicial Decisions from Ellington, Connecticut. And Allison Betts, a writer and creative executive originally from San Jose, California, whose one-day cash winnings total $28,600. Jeopardy round categories are stock photos, kinda. We've got today's hits, New York governors, fads, kitty lit, and that's so cringe.
Mm-hmm.
We had a rebound at the $1,000 level of kitty lit. The clue is, in chapter one of her first adventure, this character moves into Villa Villacula. Brian rang in and guessed who is Dora the Explorer, which at first I was like, what? Where did you get that? But then it's like Villa Villacula, I guess, could sound vaguely like Spanish inspired,
yeah,
I guess,
I see
instead
it.
Of.
And like, I'm like, that's a children's television show. But like, if you don't have kids in your house, like, you just know that Dora the Explorer is a thing.
Kid's character. Yeah.
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 It's understandable to assume that she is a literary character instead of a television character, or, you know, both, whatever.
Right.
I imagine that all of the contestants are maybe having some embarrassment about the fact that the $400 level of We've Got Today's Hits was a triple stumper with a bananarammarific title. This Taylor Swift song dominated the fall in 2023, staying at number one for weeks. Allison tried What Is Lover. Nobody tried for the rebound. That is Cruel Summer, which we have all heard 9 million times, I assume, right? Like, you can't escape it.
Not sure if it's 9 million, but enough to, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
The $400 clue I thought was strange, that The clue is, at the height of this craze, a man dashed across the stage during the Oscars, showing his shortcomings, as David Diamond put it. Sarah got it, that streaking. Was that a fad?
I don't know.
I was not aware that streaking was a fad. Like, maybe there was just a rash of streakings during that particular time. I just thought it was a thing that sometimes people did.
Yeah. Huh. Well, now I'm Googling streaking.
Oh, why are
fad.
You? Why? Don't know. No, don't Google that. I guess there are worse things to Google.
Yeah. Prominence in the 1970s.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I guess there was a time when it was especially prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
Daily double number one is the very first pick of the round, actually. Mm-hmm. Allison finds it. It's at the $800 level of Kitty Litt. And nobody has any money, it being the very first clue of the game. Allison wagers $1,000 and gets the clue. This beloved book about a stuffed animal is subtitled, or How Toys Become Real. And she knows that one. It's The Velveteen Rabbit. Mm. Aww, The Velveteen Rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's about how if you get scarlet fever, all your toys will have to be burned in a bonfire.
That's one takeaway.
That is, I've known so many people who are like, oh, that book is terrible because I got so afraid of scarlet fever.
Again, that's the takeaway.
Yeah. Anyway, at the end of the Jeopardy round, Allison is at 4,600, Sarah's at 5,200, Brian is at 200, and the double Jeopardy categories are American Birds, fake movies in movies, the Black Arts Movement, Where Do You Go, with go in quotation marks, responses will end with G-O. Drop In and Anytime. Drop In was a wordplay category where you take the letters IN out of a word to make a different word.
Mm-hmm. Fake movies and movies is always fun. We talked last week, this week, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, whatever we talked about, songs that are about songs.
Yes.
You know, fake movies in movies are always enjoyable. To me, at least, I always think it's a fun. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it, but it's something that's like,
yeah. Yeah. Although I had a hard time coming up with a lot of these. I knew Singing in the Rain and Home Alone.
Last Action Hero? Arnold? Hmm.
Yeah.
Jack Slater?
You do a pretty good Schwarzenegger.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Get to the job.
If I were doing the deep dive, it would be about the $2,000 level of the Black Arts Movement, the star of a 2023 HBO doc. This poet and her work, Black Judgment, helped take the Black Arts Movement to national prominence. Nobody tried that. That's Nikki Giovanni. She's a cool figure. She's a poet. I suspect she is not the topic of the deep dive today.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that you only do poetry deep dives when I've made so much fun of you that you have to do one when there's literally no other option.
Good. But no, it's not Nikki Giovanni.
Yeah.
In the Black Arts Movement at the $800 level, I think I brought this up in a quiz once. The clue is a poem by Askia M. Touré refers to this giant step saxophonist as a black priest prophet. Sorry, I got that. That's Coltrane. There's a Church of John Coltrane.
Oh, yeah.
That I think I mentioned. And I don't remember a lot of the specifics, but it just reminded me of oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Some people it's not just oh, yeah, he played good saxophone. They're like, he is a prophet.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's really something.
All right. Daily Double number two is in Where'd You Go at the $1,600 level. It's pick number four. Allison finds this one as well. She's at 7,000. Sarah is at 5,200. Brian's at 1,000. And she wagers everything. She goes for a true daily double, which apparently she's had nightmares about. And she gets a clue. A city in Colorado was named for this Mexican state that borders Chihuahua. And good on her. I don't know if she knew this from the Mexican state or from the city in Colorado, but she gets it correct with what is Durango. And me, I forgot the category. And I was like, oh no. I'm glad I'm not on stage because I have no idea. I don't know the Mexican states that well. I guess that'll be another deep dive of going over Mexican geography.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, no, I don't know. But then she said Durango, and I remembered. It's like, oh, yeah, it ends in go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And daily double number three is the $1,200 level of Drop In. Allison finds this one as well at pick number seven. at this point, she's at 16,000 with Sarah at 5,200 and Brian at 1,000. She wagers 2,000 and she gets the clue from a word involving respiration to get this word, meaning healthy. And she figures it out. You drop in from inhale and get what is hail. She gave both what is inhale and hail, but they just needed hail.
Yeah, I think it's safer to just get both.
Yeah.
So going into Final Jeopardy, Allison's in a locked position at 25,600. She just dominated Double Jeopardy. Those two early daily doubles put her in a big lead. And I don't know if it helped with her confidence or not, but she took over. Sarah is at 8,400. Brian is at 6,600. And the Final Jeopardy category is author's afterlives. And the clue is, after his death, his son Michel reworked and published manuscripts like one about a meteor made of gold heading for Earth. And Brian got it correct with, who is Jules Verne?
He probably listened to my deep dive.
Probably. Did you mention that Michel published a manuscript about...
No, but I did talk about like the posthumous manuscripts.
That's true. You did. Yeah. You did. Mm-hmm. I do recall that. He wagered 1801, goes up to 8401. Sarah guessed, who is Proust? Incorrect. And wagered 4801. And Allison also got it correct with, who is Verne? And added around 7,500 to go up to 33,100 in winning her second game. It feels so weird and foreign to be talking about a returning champion.
Yeah.
Because we haven't done that all season. You know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
We'll see her again on Monday.
Yes, indeed.
It's been so long since we've said that. Oh, man, that's wild. Anyway, that's the end of the week. And this is the point in the show where we remind you that we have a Patreon. It is patreon.com/potentpotables. You can go there to support us financially if you feel that that is something that you would like to do. Even just a couple bucks a month help keep this floundering podcast afloat. Just kidding, we're not floundering. We're doing fine. Because we have patrons who we appreciate very much, and they are continuing to support us and keep us solvent.
Yeah.
Is that the right?
Something like that.
Something like that. Keeping us in the black. So that's patreon.com/potentpotables. I might even remember to put the quiz questions up. Who knows?
Ooh.
The only way to find out is if you become a patron.
I did it last week. So yeah.
That's right. At patreon.com/potentpotables. All right. Oh, and also check our show notes for important causes that we think are worth your time and money, perhaps even more so than our podcast. I know it's hard to think about, but yeah, some things are more important. So check out the show notes.
Yeah.
All right, Emily, what am I talking about in my deep dive?
All right. So we had a triple stumper Final Jeopardy, and that was Coco. So that's going to be my first guess.
Not talking about Coco.
Okay. I love Coco.
It's a good movie.
Great movie.
Enjoy Coco a lot, but no.
All right. You said something about your deep dive plan being unhinged before we started recording.
I was worried that that would throw you off because it's not really going to be unhinged. But
I was looking for the most unhinged guess, and I was like, he's doing a deep dive about the question, who is your favorite child? But no, opera buffa.
I considered it, but I wasn't feeling talking about opera this week.
All right. How about Fort McHenry?
I am not talking about Fort McHenry. Although that was on the list, too.
Okay.
No, this comes from the Tuesday game, I think. It's on the Tuesday game. It was in the Double Jeopardy round, The Measure of a Man. The daily double there at the $1,600 level. Mm. You only need letters on the left side of the keyboard to type this unit of capacitance. The same for an English chap. Victoria missed it. That's the Farad, named for Michael Faraday. I want to talk about Michael Faraday.
Oh, cool. I don't know anything about Michael Faraday.
I also didn't really know anything about Michael Faraday. I'm like, I know there's a Faraday cage, and it has something to do with electricity.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
The Jeopardy clue told me he was an English chap, and so I learned that.
And it dealt with capacitance.
Yes.
I was like, yes. So, I'm going to talk about Michael Faraday.
Awesome.
I sure hope so. So, Michael Faraday was indeed a British chap. He was born September 22nd, 1791. He died August 25th, 1867. He was an English scientist, contributed to the study of electromagnetism and electrochemistry. He had a number of discoveries and various experiments and devices that are attributed to him, or that he improved, or that he helped to develop, In particular, he's known specifically for his studies in electromagnetic induction, diamagnetism, and electrolysis. Albert Einstein notably kept a picture of Faraday on his study wall alongside pictures of Arthur Schopenhauer and James Clerk Maxwell. He was that kind of important to scientific discovery of the last, you know, two centuries. In his early life, he was born in, I love this, Newington Butts, Surrey, which is now part of Southwark, or Southwark, I don't know.
Southwark, I think.
Southwark, yeah, yeah. In London. Newington Butts. His family was fairly poor. His father was a member of the Glassite sect of Christianity, which comes from the Church of Scotland, following a particular, like, a leader among the Church of Scotland. I'm not going to get into that particular sect, I guess, but it was important to his family, and it was also important to him throughout his life. His faith was, as I'll talk about in a little bit, a big part of his life, and he often sought to advance the idea of God and nature being unified through his studies. He was born the third of four children, and he only had the most basic school education, and so he had to educate himself. He was a self-made man. At the age of 14, he became an apprentice to a local bookbinder and bookseller on Blandford Street. There he read many books over his seven-year apprenticeship, including Isaac Watts' The Improvement of the Mind, and that was a big influence on his approach to learning and discovery. He attended various lectures and discussions with the City Philosophical Society during that time and developed an interest in science, especially in electricity. At the age of 20, in 1812, he ended his apprenticeship, or, well, his apprenticeship ended. I'm not sure if he ended it or if someone else did. And he attended lectures by Humphrey Davy, who was an eminent English chemist at the Royal Institution and the Royal Society. Faraday didn't have much money. He was sponsored kind of by a guy named William Dance of the Royal Philharmonic Society. So Faraday was like getting to know people, even though he kind of came from meager means. He really networked well. He schmoozed the right people and got in the right places. After those lectures, he sent Humphrey Davy a 300-page book based on notes he had taken during those lectures. And Davy's reply was favorable and swift. And so that started their kind of correspondence. In 1813, Davy damaged his eyesight in an accident with nitrogen trichloride, or trichloramine, which is a byproduct of the reactions between ammonia and chlorine, which hopefully, listeners, we all know that you don't mix ammonia and bleach because it turns into toxic and volatile gases.
There's a fun TikTok account of somebody who just duets cleaning videos until the original creator has made something poisonous, and like they always end after about 5 seconds because there are a bunch of people out there who don't know that and just like make like cleaning videos of like, watch me dump a bunch of stuff into my toilet and see how shiny it is afterwards, and he's like, you're making mustard gas. Stop.
Oh my god, don't do that. Oh god, no. Yeah. Yes, no. Keep your ammonia and your bleach away from each other.
We don't mix those.
Yes, because as we find out right here, Humphrey Davy damaged his eyesight. After that, he decided to employ Faraday as an assistant to himself, and one of the Royal Institution's assistants was sacked around the same time, and they asked Davy to find a replacement, so he just went ahead and appointed Faraday as the chemical assistant at the Royal Institution in 1813. Davy soon entrusted Faraday with the preparation of nitrogen trichloride samples, which apparently was a thing that they were studying, and they were both injured in an explosion. Like, don't... just don't mix it, people.
This is great.
Just don't do it.
I mean, terrible, but...
terrible, but like, yeah, also, these are scientists, and they're like, oops, it blew up. Mm-hmm. Aside from his scientific studies, in 1821, in June, he married Sarah Barnard. They met through their families in the church, and they had no children. I didn't really look into their marriage, but it seems to have been fine. There does not seem to have been much drama or really much of note. They had no children. As far as I know, they remained married and had no particular issues. So good on them. Like I said, he was a devout Christian of the Sandemanian denomination. Again, this comes from that Glassite following. John Glass was a Scottish preacher, and his son-in-law, Robert Sandeman, was the one who like spread the teachings. So that's why there's Sandemanians. Anyway, he was a devout Christian, and like I said, he had a strong sense of unity of God and nature. he was also fairly active in his church and in like humanitarian efforts or other things, but I'll talk about that a little bit later. Let's talk about his scientific accomplishments. His earliest chemical work was, like I said, as an assistant to Humphrey Davy. He was involved in the study of chlorine. He discovered two new compounds of chlorine and carbon, hexachlorethane and carbon tetrachloride. I'm not going to get into those, but he discovered some new compounds. He also conducted the first rough experiments on the diffusion of gases, which was a phenomenon that was first pointed out by John Dalton, who was a chemist and physicist of like the previous generation. John Dalton, for trivia people, is an important name because he is the one who introduced the atomic theory into chemistry. Also, apparently he researched colorblindness, and colorblindness is sometimes known as Daltonism. So there's a little bit about John Dalton. John Dalton, coincidentally, is the one who I always confuse with Joseph Priestley. So now I have them separate. He successfully liquefied several gases, investigated the alloys of steel, and produced several new kinds of glass intended for optical purposes. He later on would use some of these heavy glasses in ways to demonstrate magnetism and magnetic fields and like polarization of light. So his work with like optic lenses was impactful on his later work.
Mm-hmm.
He also invented an early form of what was to become the Bunsen burner, which we see in, you know, science labs all over. He also discovered benzene, the substance benzene. Mm-hmm. And in the process of liquefying gases, he helped to establish that gases are the vapors of liquid possessing a very low boiling point, which gave a better grasp of the concept of molecular aggregation. He was also the first to report what later became known as metallic nanoparticles. In 1847, he discovered that the optical properties of gold colloids differed from those of the corresponding bulk metal. So like a colloid is like a mixture where there is a substance of microscopically dispersed insoluble particles suspended throughout another substance. If you're not super familiar with scientific terminology, what's a good example? Milk? Milk is, I think, a good example of a colloid because when it's homogenized, it has the fats kind of like broken down and mixed in, but the fat isn't dissolved, right? It's not like broken apart into, you know, smaller molecules or atoms within the solution. It's just like microscopic pieces of the fat that's mixed in. That's a colloid. Mm-hmm. So he looked at that with gold and realized that it has different properties than like a hunk of gold. And this was probably the first reported observation of the effects of quantum size and could be like the beginnings of nanoscience. So that's all other stuff he did aside from electricity and magnetism. He is best known, of course, for those things. His first recorded experiment in electricity was the construction of a voltaic pile in 1812, I believe. A voltaic pile is like the previous version of what we call a battery. It's a device that can continuously provide an electric current to a circuit. In that one, he used halfpenny coins stacked together with discs of zinc and some paper moistened with salt water. And he used it to decompose magnesium sulfate solution. And that showed that he could, you know, direct electrical current from this voltaic pile into a solution. In 1821, Hans Christian Oersted, the Danish physicist and chemist, discovered the phenomenon of electromagnetism. So Faraday didn't discover it, Oersted did, but Davy and William Hyde Wollaston tried and failed to design an electric motor based on that. Faraday took that on himself, and he produced two devices that created what he called electromagnetic rotation. Those are now known as homopolar motors. They cause a continuous circular motion by the circular magnetic force around a wire, and it was put into a pool of mercury wherein was placed a magnet. These experiments and inventions form the foundation of modern electromagnetic technology. Ugh. Faraday was really excited, and so he published the results without talking to Wollaston or Davy. That caused some controversy in the Royal Society, and Davy got kind of upset with him, and as a result, Faraday's assignments pointed to other things with the Royal Society. He was not involved with electromagnetic research for several years, which gotta love when pride gets in the way of, like, you know, human progress. That didn't mean that he stopped like thinking about it and working on it. He did continue work in electromagnetism, exploring different materials and the properties and potentials of those materials. In 1824, he briefly set up a circuit to study whether a magnetic field could regulate the flow of a current in an adjacent wire, but he found that it could not. He spent much of his time over the next 7 years perfecting his recipe for optical quality glass, borosilicate of lead, which he used in further studies connecting light with magnetism. He published his experimental work on optics and electromagnetism in his spare time, and he continued corresponding with different scientists throughout the continent who were working on the same. 2 years after Davy's death, in 1831, he began a series of experiments in which he discovered electromagnetic induction, which is the production of an electromotive force across an electrical conductor in a charging magnetic field. His breakthrough came when he wrapped two insulated coils of wire around an iron ring and found that upon passing a current through one coil, a momentary current was induced in the other coil. This is known as mutual inductance. So it's the tendency of an electrical conductor to oppose a charge in the electric current flowing through it. I don't fully wrap my head around like the exact meaning of that, but like I'm giving words which might trigger something in someone else's mind. He found that in later experiments, if he moved a magnet through a loop of wire, an electric current flowed in that wire, which is how microphones work. When you talk into a microphone, a very sensitive diaphragm moves, and that diaphragm has a magnet, and there's a coil of wire going all around it, and when that magnet moves, it creates an electrical current. So, like, literally right now, that's what's happening. His demonstrations established that a changing magnetic field produces an electrical field. This relation was modeled mathematically by James Clerk Maxwell, and it is called Faraday's Law. Faraday's Law became one of the four Maxwell equations, which are a set of differential equations that form the foundation of classical electromagnetism, classical optics, electric and magnetic circuits. But I'm not talking about Maxwell in this one. I'm talking about Faraday. So get out of here, Maxwell. Eventually, all of that turned into what is known as field theory today. In 1832, he completed a series of experiments aimed at investigating the fundamental nature of electricity, and we get words like static, batteries, animal electricity, electrolysis, things like that. He concluded from these experiments that, contrary to the scientific opinion at the time, there was no division between types of electricity. And in fact, electricity was just electricity. And the changing values in the quantity and intensity would produce different groups of phenomena. He later in his career argued that electromagnetic forces extended into the empty space around the conductor. Fellow scientists at the time rejected that idea, but we now pretty much know that that was actually true. Electromagnetic fields are emanated, you know, around conductors. In 1845, he discovered that many materials exhibit a weak repulsion from a magnetic field, and he termed that diamagnetism. He also discovered that a plane of polarization of linearly polarized light can be rotated by the application of an external magnetic field aligned with the direction in which the light is moving. That's called the Faraday effect. Polarization of linearly polarized light can be rotated by the application of an external magnetic field aligned with the direction in which the light is moving. Polarized light, for most of us, we deal with that when it comes to like 3D glasses or sunglasses. It cuts out some of the wavelengths of light, some of the waves, because they are moving in a certain polar pattern, and the thing you put on your face blocks those out. Also, we know of the Faraday cage. He had an experiment called the Ice Pail Experiment, performed in 1843, and that demonstrated that the charge in static electricity resided only on the exterior of a charged conductor. And exterior charge had no influence on anything enclosed within a conductor. This is because the exterior charges redistribute such that the interior fields emanating from them cancel one another. And that gives a shielding effect to whatever is inside the conductor. And that's what a Faraday cage is. In January 1836, he built a wooden frame 12 feet square on four glass supports, added paper walls and wire mesh. Then he stepped inside and electrified it. And when he stepped out of the cage to the shock and delight of the audience, he showed that electricity was a force, not an imponderable fluid, as was believed at the time. So those are his like scientific contributions. Real quick, I mentioned he was with the Royal Institution. He had some appointments there, as well as elected a fellow of the Royal Society in 1824. He turned down a lot of leadership positions. He was asked to be president of the Royal Society multiple times. He cited his faith for a number of those, saying like he did not seek to pursue wealth or fame, and that it was his, you know, his purpose to simply do what he believed he should. He also became the Fullerian Professor of Chemistry at the Royal Institution in 1833. He also did work for private firms, like he worked on the glass lenses that Charles Brothers lighthouses would use. He did some forensic investigation into an explosion in County Durham that killed 95 miners. He's also active in environmental science. He investigated the industrial pollution at Swansea and was consulted on air pollution at the Royal Mint. He was also a judge and a planner for the exhibits at the Great Exhibition in 1851, which you have talked about, as well as advising the National Gallery on cleaning and protection of its art collection. He did a lot of things. He was very, very prominent. He gave a series of 19 Christmas lectures for young people at the Royal Institution. It's a series which continues today to present science to the general public. Yeah. So that's what he did. He's been commemorated all over. I'm not going to list a whole bunch of them. There is a Faraday Institute for Science and Religion, which started in 2006. Building at London South Bank University is named for him. There's a statue in Savoy Place. Yeah. He was elected a foreign honorary member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the Swedish Royal Academy of Sciences. He was very, very well known for his work. He had a nervous breakdown in 1839, but eventually returned to his investigations. And he was awarded a house in Hampton Court in 1848 as a result of the representations by Prince Albert. He was later called on by the British government to advise on the production of chemical weapons for use in the Crimean War, and he refused. Good on him, not wanting to build chemical weapons. And he died in his house at Hampton Court in 1867 at the age of 65. He had previously turned down an offer of burial at Westminster Abbey, but there is a memorial plaque there near Isaac Newton's tomb, and he is interred at the dissenters section of the Highgate Cemetery. Whew, that was a lot.
Yeah.
But there is Michael Faraday and his eponymous cage.
Very cool.
All right.
I know so much more about him now than I did before this. Yeah.
And I don't expect the science did not stick in my mind and probably won't, but at least I know what to associate with him more specifically now.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. You ready for a quiz or what?
Yeah, let's have a quiz.
All right. This is just riffing off of words that were in the deep dive. So cool. No real theme here.
Okay.
All right. Question one. A Faraday cage acts as a shield by distributing an electrostatic charge to an external environment. Johnny Cage fights for glory, wealth, and his life against the likes of Sub-Zero, Raiden, Liu Kang, and Goro in what video game series that spawned a questionable 90s movie and a real banger of a track?
I don't know. Is it Mortal Kombat?
It is Mortal Kombat. Absolutely, it's Mortal Kombat. Mortal Kombat.
I got it.
You got it. Yes. Was it the 90s movie that gave it away? Or was it just you guessed a fighting game?
I guessed a fighting game.
Well done.
Pretty much.
Yes. Mortal Kombat. Of course, spelled with a K. Why?
It is notes here. I did spell it with a K.
Yeah.
Do I know anything about Mortal Kombat besides that it's a fighting game and you spell combat with a K? I do not.
Well, now you know that Johnny Cage is a character.
Yeah, there we go.
And Goro has four arms. So my very tall friend and I in high school would walk up behind him and put my arms out around him and then say Goro. And we'd walk around with four arms. Anyway, good job. You got 10 points.
Woo!
Yeah. On to question two. Polarization affects the rotation of light in electromagnetic fields. The Polar Express is a 1985 Caldecott winner by Chris Van Allsburg. The titular locomotive was based on a Class N1284 Berkshire Steam locomotive formerly owned by Michigan State University. That locomotive is a Père Marquette with what four-number designation, which inspired Van Allsburg to associate it with the holiday?
1225
is correct. Yes, it is the Père Marquette 1225. There is only one other Class N1284 Berkshire Steam locomotive of the Père Marquette that is still in existence, and that is 1223. Yeah. And in fact, that particular locomotive was used as the model for the movie when they did the graphic design for the animation.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yes, very good. All right, 20 points. Question three, Royal Society. There aren't too many royals left in the world. In fact, ignoring the UK Commonwealth, only three monarchies remain in Africa. One is an absolute monarchy, so much so that the king can change the country's name. One is parliamentary, sort of like the nation around it. And the third is semi-constitutional, with a constitution dating from 1631. Name them for 3 points each, or 10 if you get all three.
Okay. I think the absolute one has to be the one that recently changed his name. That is Eswatini.
Okay, you got Eswatini.
All right, parliamentary something something country around it. I think we are talking about Lesotho.
We are talking about Lesotho.
All right, and then semi-constitutional dating from 1631.
I will also say it is quite not in the same region as those other two.
Okay.
I have a couple of clues if you need them.
I will take a clue.
Okay. This country, despite being a monarchy, was the first to acknowledge the independence of the United States, which I know we have mentioned before on the podcast.
Yeah, somewhere northern Africa, I think.
The other clue I would give is that it is currently ruled by King Mohammed VI.
Thinking about Morocco, I don't think that's it. I think it might be Tunisia. I think I'm going to go with Tunisia.
Tunisia is a republic. You said the right one. It is Morocco.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yes, Morocco is one of the oldest monarchies in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, like I said, it has a constitution, sort of, that dates back all the way to the 1600s. Looking at it, I believe Japan is technically the oldest monarchy, dating back to, like, the 600s.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah. Yeah, it is Morocco. So there we go. But yeah, you got Eswatini and you got Lesotho, so you got 6 points.
All right. Could be worse.
Question four. Battery can mean many things, including a device that holds and distributes electricity or an array of heavy weapons. In a marching band setting, pre-fatherhood Nick Cannon could tell you that it can refer to what group of musicians?
I think it's got to be like the drums, right? Like, what else would it be? I don't remember who Nick Cannon is right now. That clue is not clicking for me.
Oh, no. It all hinges on that.
Oh, no.
I mean, not really.
Yeah, I'm going to have to say, I'm going to say drums and hope for the best.
Okay. Can you be more specific? Particularly in a marching band setting. Maybe what section am I talking about?
I'm not really sure how to be more specific here.
All right, I'll take it. I'll take it. Okay. Drums is fine. I'm looking for the drum line.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Particularly.
Yes. As opposed to, are there drums that are not the drum line, or is it just in the marching band you call it the drum line?
Well, Emily, I'm glad you asked. Yes. So in a typical marching band setup, the drum line are the musicians who are marching on the field with drums. So you have your snare drums, you have your tenor drums, which can be quads or quints. Uh-huh. You have your bass drums, your marching bass drums. You might also have a cymbal line or cymbal player, crash cymbals, as part of your drum line, as part of your battery. Then, at the front of the field, musicians who do not march are part of the front ensemble or the pit. And there you have percussion instruments like xylophones, marimbas, the big concert bass drum, which is a drum, also timpani, which is a drum, but not a marching drum. You might have tom racks or gongs or any other instrument that you need that isn't going to be marched with is going to be the front ensemble. So technically, the drum line is a subset of your percussion.
Okay.
Also, it's a 2002 film starring Nick Cannon.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, you got
it. Cool. All right. Yeah.
There you go. So you're at 36 points. Mm-hmm. Question five. James Clerk Maxwell's house was in Edinburgh, and I didn't find any information on how long it was good for or if it still is. Maxwell House coffee, on the other hand, is good for how long?
I sure hope we're not asking about, like, the expiration date, because I'm going to say to the last drop.
Well, it is good to the last drop, Emily. Slogans count as trivia. So there you go. Good job. 46 points. going into the final. Nice. And the category is TV and movie. I have absolutely nothing to add about Maxwell House Coffee.
I am trying to check whether it's Maxwell House or Folgers. Oh, no, it's Folgers that has the horrifying commercial. Are you familiar with the Folgers commercial?
I don't think so.
To find Folgers, it, you have to...
horrifying have to, commercial.
You'll probably get it with that.
Oh, the Folgers incest commercial?
That's the one.
Well, I will watch this later,
watch
I
it
guess.
Later.
All right. Wow, now I... Oh, God. Okay.
All right, cool. Anyway, that has nothing to do with Maxwell House, though.
TV and movies is the final category.
TV and movies. If I wager everything, I can get to 92. Let's wager all but one. I'm going to wager 45 points.
Sounds good. For
91. Which is still an A-, I think.
Depends on who you're talking to.
Cool.
I had classes where a 92 was a B+.
Ugh.
Anyway, here we go. Humphrey Davy was Faraday's mentor and sponsor for a time. Davy and Goliath was a children's program from the 60s. The titular characters taught Christianity-driven moral lessons in a crude version of what style of animation? Nick Park demonstrated a smoother version with A Grand Day Out in 1989, The Wrong Trousers in 1993, and A Close Shave in 1995, among others.
Uh-huh. It's a claymation or stop-motion animation?
Yeah, it is claymation, clay animation. Yes, love me some Wallace and Gromit.
I love Wallace and Gromit. It's so good.
The Wrong Trousers.
Have you seen the feature-length Curse of the Were-Rabbit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
More than once.
Yes.
Enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed it very much. Jeez, Gromit. Anyway, we're not going to devolve into Wallace and Gromit. You got 91 points, which I think might be the first time we've ever had that number.
Woo! We're still doing things new.
Scorigami. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well done, Emily.
Thank you, Kyle. And thank you for an excellent deep dive and a great quiz. This was very fun. And thank you, listeners, for spending your time with us. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a rating or review if you have a minute to do that. If you want to check out our Patreon, it's patreon.com/potentpotables. And if you have friends who like Jeopardy, tell them about us.
You can all find us on Facebook at Potent Potables, on Twitter at Potent Potables 1. Our email address is potentpotablescast@gmail.com, and our website is potentpod.com.
And we'll be back next week with more Jeopardy. So until then, may your minds be quick and your buzzers be quicker.